Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world thinking beyond sell the team. We're going to buy the team. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Can I borrow 10 bucks? Let's purchase the Oakland A's.
It's going to take a little bit more than that, but boy, does that look like a entity that I would like to be a part of, that I would like to invest in, Jake Mintz. It is Wednesday morning. Last night, we witnessed one of the stranger, cooler, most inspiring, most depressing, so many emotions coming out of the reverse boycott at the Coliseum. We are going to have our friend Kyle Madsen join us. He was in attendance. He is going to tell us what it was all about, but we have to lead with that. So we are going to talk about what we saw, at least on television, before we hear from Kyle what it was like in person. And then later on, we are going to talk about some other non-Oakland A's things. I know we spend so much time talking about this team that still hasn't won its 20th game of the season, but they probably will soon. W7, baby. Later on, we'll talk Subway Series. we'll talk Gary Sanchez and Aaron Hicks making the Yankees look silly. We will talk Carlos Correa and Gunnar Henderson and Corbin Carroll, and then a wonderful email, and then we will say goodbye because we have to go to Omaha. But Jake, this is a Major League Baseball podcast, and we will talk about Major League Baseball. And you know where there's still Major League Baseball, Jake? Oakland, California.
Before we talk about last night, just a very brief overview of how we got here for anybody hopping into this story at this moment in time. It is very simple. The ownership group of the A's, led by a gentleman named John Fisher, who is the heir to the Gap clothing company fortune, which is still hilarious to me. He is literally Baby Gap, right? Like, the owner is Baby Gap. The team has decided to try and leave for Las Vegas, Nevada. In doing so, they have not invested in the team or the stadium to the point that fans have stopped coming to games, understandably. They're using that as an excuse to look for other options. It is also worth noting that yesterday, the Nevada State Legislature approved a $380 million public stadium package for the Oakland A's after that special session that happened last week. Some of those clips went viral. And so the timing here was very bizarre because it was the worst possible news, the biggest possible sign that the A's will actually move that we've really had so far since the original announcement. And that was coupled with the day that had been planned for weeks in advance for all the fans to come to the stadium, voice their displeasure with the current ownership group, but also show the world and the baseball community just how passionate they are about the team and that the fan base is active and is there when they are invested in.
Yeah, and I think I'm excited to hear, you know, from Kyle how it really felt in the stadium, But to your point, yeah, it was both the perfect time to kind of react to that and to feel that even stronger with that news coming out yesterday, and the worst because it kind of started to set in more. Now, there are still many more stages of this process, many more bills that need to be passed, relocation, you know, processes within Major League Baseball beyond just the Nevada government that are going to happen. But we know that this is where they are trying to go, and this does seem like where it is going to end up. And so to your point, for that to drop yesterday to almost power this movement even further, you know, maybe that news is what drove an extra 3,000 or 5,000 fans out yesterday. You know, like, that's the thing. And it felt so, it came through on television, of course. And what we could not have possibly foreseen, as this is something that has been going on, been planned, as you mentioned, for weeks, if not months, is that the Oakland A's would be coming home on this winning streak, setting up an opportunity for the fans to not just voice their displeasure and to wear a bunch of sell t-shirts and tell, you know, communicate on television and join together how upset and frustrated they are, which is all important, but that the A's fans could also be A's fans for a night and root for a team that was competitive. And no matter who cares what they finish the record with, like, that is just such an incredible kind of sequence of events that I'm so thankful for, and I'm sure they are as well.
If the Rays had come out yesterday and mollywopped Oakland into submission in the third inning and won 14-2, it would have been a very different tone at the end of the game. Like, the fans are still mad, and no amount of wins at this point in the season can fix anything, really. But if they lose 14-2, like, it's an atmosphere of frustration. And what this was I think Tim Kuhn wrote about this at ESPN. It was in between a wake and a party, right? Like it was both of those things at the same time. It was a celebration and it was a mourning. Mm-hmm. And that is such a unique atmosphere to have at a baseball game. I had buddies of mine who don't give a crap about baseball texting me this morning about it. It felt very like European soccer, right? Like Fisher out, like sell the team. Like it's yeah. very Euro footy in that way.
And again, like I said, how we know the A's are still going to end up being one of the worst teams in baseball. But as the fans will tell you, they're smart. We all know it's not the players' fault. The players are trying their best. They're being put in a position, a lot of these players that don't have major league experience, that it's just, it's difficult to succeed against other teams with more resources, with more experienced players, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, the fact that we have guys like Hogan Harris, you know, and Carlos Perez and all these rosters, like, the fans getting the opportunity to celebrate the players wearing these jerseys is cool because they know it's not these players' fault. They know that they're trying their best. And even though that would have been true if they did lose 14-2, the fact that those players who might not get an opportunity like this again for the rest of their time this season or next season when it sounds like they're still going to be in Oakland is great because it's not the players' fault. And I'm glad that their hard work and their perseverance through this shitty situation that they didn't ask for is also being rewarded with the support of the fans. Like that was also really cool. I know that that is kind of a much smaller issue than the larger issue at hand. And the fans will tell you that too. But that was cool to see because we know the players on these teams, like that is not something that they necessarily wanted to deal with.
And you know who else is perpetually frustrated with ownership and management? Baseball players. And so these guys behind the scenes are saying and thinking and feeling a lot of the same things that the fans are feeling. Now, the one difference I just want to highlight is like the facilities. Like players love complaining about facilities. And I know players around the league are like happy about the idea of a new facility in Vegas. Like that is maybe the one difference. Mm-hmm. But as far as being mistreated and not invested in and not supported, like the players feel the same thing in Oakland that the fans feel. They just can't really come out and say it as explicitly because they are being, you know, employed by the team. A couple other notes from last night. 27,759 fans. Okay. That is three times more than the average attendance this season, which is just a really remarkable number.
Yeah. Now, obviously, it was also a reminder like, oh, yeah, this is a massive stadium. They have a lot of seats that they could fill if they wanted to. But yeah, most biggest attendance of the season ahead of opening day by a couple thousand. And honestly, you know, it's possible it was more than that. I don't know how exactly that they were. I would love to understand more the exact science behind how they announce attendance for major league games, because oftentimes it's the opposite situation. You look around, and you say, wow, there's 3,000 people here. And they say, announced attendance is 8,142. And you're like, that is not true. There is no way that is possible. In this case, it was like 27,000. I don't know. It might be more than that.
It was certainly a lot of people. And what the A's did something very bizarre a couple of hours before first pitch, where they announced that they were going to donate all of the ticket proceeds from this game. This is the team, okay? Announcing that they're going to donate all the ticket proceeds to the Alameda County Community Food Bank and the Oakland Public Education Fund, which is great. Community investment's great. These big teams donating money to where they are is great, whatever. But they announced a specific dollar figure, which is weird, which was, again, $811,107. This team is basically saying, if we sell 27,000 tickets, we make nearly $1 million. Probably more than that with like food, drink, and all this other shit, right? Parking, whatever. Like we make $1 million a game. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, then invest in the team.
Yeah, it's like, then why is your payroll $40 million? Like it was this thing where it's like, okay, good. Now, to what ends are you winning a PR war at this point? Because sure, it's nice. Obviously, no one's going to say it's bad to donate $800,000 to the city. That's great. But if this is your way of saying like, well, here's a nice thing we're doing on our way out, like weird, and also admitting how much money you're making anyway, which we all could have inferred regardless, is ridiculous. Which also brings me back to another point that I want to make. And maybe we'll get into this with Kyle a little bit, but it was just a reminder of how little it takes for fans to fucking care, right? Like to give them, and I know this was a complete unique situation, but again, I keep thinking about the Reds, right? The Reds are another fan base who, is not happy with their ownership for reasons that make all kinds of sense. And at the end of last season, like, that's really what it felt like we were heading towards, is a similar kind of thing. They had 2 months ago, they had the lowest attendance that they've ever had, also against the Rays on a Monday night or on a Tuesday night. Like, that just happened this season. All it takes is just getting a couple players that you have actually cultivated and developed and brought up together. And I know Ace fans are like, yeah, well, we've done that. And we've traded them away, and that is a bigger part of the problem. But the point is that it doesn't take a lot. Like, fans want to care. They want to go to the game. You just have to give them the smallest inkling that you are pushing towards something, that you are building something, and that you can bring up one exciting young player or exciting young pitcher. And we even felt that for an ounce when Mason Miller came up and threw 100 miles an hour. Like, it was all these small little things. It doesn't take that much. We're not, for fans to desperately want to care. And so that's what makes all this so sad, right? That's what makes all this so frustrating and infuriating, but also cool to see for at least one night.
One final thought here, right? What does this actually accomplish? Because in a bubble, in a moment, it is remarkable. It is impressive. It is commendable to the grassroots community organizations in Oakland that put this together, that raised the money to give away 8,000 t-shirts that said sell on them, right? To get all the people quiet. There was the moment where, because they've been in Oakland for 55 years, at the beginning of the fifth inning, they had everyone in the stadium silent. Jose Siri hit a double, and then they broke in to sell the team chants. That were deafening, right? That level of organization is remarkable. It's impressive. Okay, but what does it actually do? Are the A's are leaving. I have reached a point now where, like, I know there's a lot more hurdles. This team is going to Vegas, right? That is, in my mind, like, that is happening. So what is this doing? This is showing other ownership, potential ownership groups around the country and around the world that baseball can work in this town if they are invested in. And so I joked earlier about the sell t-shirts. They should be really saying buy t-shirts, because what A's fans are saying, hello, we're worth it, right? Like, whether it's Fisher is not going to sell. That's not happening if they get the stadium in Vegas, right? Mm-hmm. But they're hoping that someone else comes in and puts baseball back in this city, because the city deserves it. That was just my takeaway, man. I was just so impressed. Mm-hmm. Like, the gears of capitalism will win. Usually, right, in this society we participate in every day. But for a day, for a moment, for a glimpse, for a fleeting evening, A's fans and their passion and their joy and their unity mm-hmm. created something that they'll have for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And if it all falls into place like a fairy tale, baseball will be in Oakland once the A's inevitably leave.
We'll see. We'll see. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Kyle Madsen will join us and give us an on the ground report, give us a little bit more color regarding what it felt like to be in the Coliseum last night. So we'll be right back here on Baseball Barbcast.
This is former PGA Tour winner Smiley Kaufman, host of The Smiley Show, a SiriusXM podcast. You want to know what I love about golf? I get to talk to some really cool people. I get to walk the fairways of the best courses in the world with the best players in the world, and I get to share it with you every single week. Listen to The Smiley Show right now on Stitcher, Pandora, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Smiley, S-M-Y-L-I-E.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Our conversation on the reverse boycott rolls on with someone who was there doing some reverse boycotting himself, Mr. Kyle Madsen. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Baseball Barbacast, my friend.
This is one of the best days of my life. I'm not going to lie. You guys do such a good job with this pod. I'm so happy to be on.
You are way too kind. Kyle, before you say nice things about us, please establish your credentials. Why were you there last night? Why was this an important night to you? And I guess, you know, what's the day job so people sort of know what you're about?
Man, well, right now my day job is I write about and podcast about the San Francisco 49ers, but I love baseball. Baseball is my favorite sport and always has been. I grew up going to games at the Coliseum. And last night was about showing baseball and just kind of showing the world that fans aren't the issue in Oakland. And I've believed that for a long time, you know, going back to when they traded Mark Mulder and got this whole cycle of trading stars going. And it's really clear it's been an ownership problem, and I wanted to be part of the you know, almost 28,000 that were there to show that.
So give us a bit of background, like, on how this day came about. Where did you first hear of the reverse boycott, and how do you think it grew to the point that, like you said, 28,000 people were there?
I first saw it on Twitter, like, back at the start of the year. And to be totally frank, at first I was like, this is a dumb idea. Why are you going to give money to the guy who's taking this? Is that what are that's the that that's opposite, like, that's counterintuitive, right? And then it was kind of there, and you'd see a retweet of a post about it every once in a while. But I was so worried that it was going to be 10,000 people, and they're playing the best team in baseball. Like, the Rays are loaded, and like, okay, cool. They're going to go get housed by the Rays, and 10,000 people are going to show up, and it's just going to make us look really bad. But then in like the 5 days leading up to the game, it was all over the place. And there's news outlets covering it locally and nationally. There's a bunch of people who I didn't even know liked baseball on social media that, you know, talking about getting their tickets, and they're giving away tickets, and local radio stations are giving away tickets. So in the last kind of week, it ramped up to a new level. And I think that's why there was such an incredible turnout.
And I don't think this is entirely because of it, but we already talked before we had you on, the confluence of this winning streak kind of made this bizarre situation even more special. And I know that that's not as important as the larger issue at hand, of course, but it was cool to me. What was so cool is that you not only got to go voice your, you know, opinion and your feelings and your emotions and what this team means to you as fans, just in general, but also, like, you got to go be, you know, rowdy, badass Rays fans for a night. Like, that seemed to be like a bonus on top of it that, as you said, you could have never even anticipated that, even with the six games they had won in a row going into last night.
Yeah, the Rays beat them 11-0 on consecutive days earlier this year. that's kind of what I was a little bit worried about. And frankly, if they get smoked last night, it doesn't go the same. I think people show up and it's loud, but I mean, from the first batter, you heard it. The energy was super high all night. And then they go down a run, and it wasn't like, oh, they're going to lose. If they had lost 8 in a row and they gone down by a run, it would have felt like they were down 10. But they've been winning, and they go up 1-0, or they go down 1-0, and then they make it 2-1. And at that point, it felt like they weren't going to lose. And that's, I think, part of the reason the energy was so high, like you said, was it was this feeling of, hey, this team's not going anywhere. There's no delusions. Nobody in that stadium thinks they're going to the playoffs. They could break I was thinking about this last night. They could break the Guardians winning streak and still be like 15 games under 500.
Yes.
That's where I made this
point on Monday's show, where it's just like, the most amazing thing about their 5-game winning streak at that point is that it further highlighted that they were 12-50. They were 12-50. like this is that's not a record a Major League Baseball team should have, but here we are. But to your point, I feel like it made it all the more special, and that translated on TV also. But Jake, go ahead.
Well, I actually want to know what wasn't on TV. So I want to know about the parking lot, because if you've ever been to the Coliseum, it's a big ass parking lot. Like, that's a parking lot. It's a colossal parking lot. And it seemed like the energy, like, in the stadium, the team can control things a little bit. Mm-hmm. Outside the stadium, they have no control. Zero, mm-hmm. Zilch. So describe to me what the vibe was like in the parking lot before the game.
It felt like a playoff game. And I thought that, I took BART in, that's our local Bay Area Rapid Transit, our train. And I took BART in, and when I transferred to the train that was going to the Coliseum, it was all green. And I've never seen that. It's like 3 hours before first pitch. And that already, but nobody wanted to be like loud and rowdy on the train. But as soon as you got off and you were walking across the ramp to get to the stadium, there was just like a palpable buzz. And then the 68s, the group that's, you know, kind of behind the grassroots effort to keep the team here in Oakland, had a big tailgate out in the corner of the parking lot. And it felt legitimately, I keep saying playoff game, but that's what the atmosphere was like. Again, 2-3 hours before first pitch, it's just people ready to be loud, people ready to show their support. Ace fans have been dragged for so long because, I mean, of course, people aren't going to know what's going on with ownership and the team trying to move. Like, that's not something that somebody in Pittsburgh or Cleveland gives a damn about, right? Mm-hmm. So that opportunity and the support from baseball fans around the league and nationally, I think really got people up to party.
Because you have a lot of people being like, LOL, empty stadium picture, right?
Right.
And
right.
There's context behind why those pictures exist, but Twitter and social media is not a place for context and sophistication and nuance, as we know. Were people in the parking lot mad? Like, I'm sure people were frustrated, but was there anger?
Yeah, I think so. Not outwardly towards each other. Like, it was very cordial, and it was beer and substances and, you know, just a normal tailgate. It was people having a good time.
The jerseys weren't the only thing that was green, am I right?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, that's a very good way to say it. there were signs like actual like cardboard signs that weren't super nice. And that was like, there was definitely vitriol. Like, you heard sell the team was the chant for most of the night. It's not, and that's not a, hey guys, could you maybe do this? Like, people were pissed. And I think there was, on top of the energy of 7 wins in a row and wanting to keep the team here, I think there was definitely some anger and frustration being let out by people who either have or who have not been to a game in the last, you know, 10 or so years.
Well, and another part of it that, of course, you see the people with the jerseys, with all the former A's that not that long ago, you know, and are now starring on other teams. And that's been part of the frustration is they have built up these teams and then torn them down on purpose. And they're not the only team that has done that. I mean, the Rays in some ways have done it a lot more successfully. But it was also kind of wild because it was 4 years ago. These two teams were in that one game wild card. There were 54,000. It was double the number of people that were there last night at that game. And I know Oakland ultimately lost that game because Yandy Diaz was like, "Hey guys, I'm actually one of the best hitters in the world. You guys just don't know it yet." Were you there for that? Were you at that game?
No, I was in Hawaii for that.
Ooh, okay,
but I was set up at a bar on the beach. So I'm at a bar on the beach and I'm ready to take off into the ocean. I was so confident the A's were winning that game. I was like, this is the year. They're going to figure it out. This is a really good team. And then Manaea falls apart. And by the fifth inning, I was like 4 Jack and Cokes deep and just went back to my room. I was like, no beach for me tonight. I gotta get out of here.
So I apologize for hearkening back to that. But the reason I wanted to mention that, and even, you know, the goofy 2020 postseason, obviously the fans aren't involved in that one. But like, it was a reminder, to your point, feeling like a playoff game. We've watched A's playoff games in this dumpy stadium multiple times over the last decade. Like, we know what it looks like. We know what this fan base can be. And that is was also a great reminder. And it helped, to your point, that it was this close game against the best team in baseball with this winning streak. And that also felt important. And now, the big question, and we sort of talked about this before we had you on, is to what end, right? This is actually going to make a difference or whatnot. But I'm just glad they had the opportunity. And you, fans like you, had the opportunity to do that and to feel that one more time. Because what it felt like was also one last opportunity to do that when the team has been, you know, completely, you know, ripped down to the, absolute studs, that it looked like, oh my God, we're not going to have a reasonable team to cheer for until they're gone.
Let me ask this. Was it therapeutic? Do you feel better today about baseball in Oakland than you did a day ago?
I feel good about what happened, but again, I know the reality of this. I'm not dumb. People aren't dumb. It's not like we went, oh, hey, 27,759 or whatever the number was, showed up. They're not moving anymore. Like, John Fisher doesn't care,
right? He's not seeing the parking lot and is being like, you know what?
Yeah,
this is great.
Yeah, like they don't give a damn, and that's fine. But the goal was to show that this was not the goal was to get John Fisher to sell the team, but that obviously is not going to happen. So the bigger goal was, hey, there's fans here. This is a market that can hold baseball. Like, look at the 1970s. Look at the 1980s. This was a team that sold out that stadium, by the way, the same one, sold it out and had 2 million plus fans a year and had the highest payroll in baseball. Like, it's a viable baseball market. There should be baseball here. And that was the thing that kind of struck me the most last night is, I don't know how you watch that on a Tuesday night against the Rays in the middle of June for a team that went in 18-50, and you watch that energy and you watch how people responded and go, oh, this is not a place that baseball should be. That's ludicrous to me.
Yep. Because people want to care. They're not asking for much. They're really not asking for much. They just want to give you a reason to give a shit.
They need a new stadium, right? Like, it was 28,000 there last night. That place is not equipped. The A's were not equipped to have 28,000 people there. Like, they weren't. And that was half of the capacity without Mount Davis open. So that place is just not built. They do need a new stadium. But going to Las Vegas, I don't think, and this is totally guessing, and maybe it's my bias, but I just don't think that you're going to get the environment in Las Vegas that you got last night in the middle of June with a bad team. If they invest in this team and they get a stadium that the casual fan, who may or may not be a diehard, who may or may not know who Ramon Laureano is or you know, whoever, it at least wants to go to and at least wants to be part of. So,
and that's what, when Jake went earlier this year, we went to a game, we talked a lot about how, because this is why the stadium is such a big deal, is that no one wants to go because it's fun to go to a baseball game there, right? Mm-hmm. You do have to give them some reason for casual people to think it's cool and fun and enjoyable and easy and pleasant to just go to a ball game, even if you've never heard of any of the players. Because that can still exist, even if the team sucks. That is still possible. We see that in other markets. You can do it. It is a thing. It is a sustainable thing if you actually try. But because it's not happening.
It is all the Rockies do.
That's what is happening every day in Colorado. Like, there's versions of this that exist.
My wife and I went to DC for our honeymoon. And I was like, if I'm going to DC, I'm going to a Nats game, right? I went to more Nats games than I went to A's games last year. It's soft boycott for me in 2021, or 2022. But it's the same thing. Like, at Nats Park, you can pull up on the Metro and walk up to the stadium, and as you're walking up, there's bars and restaurants, and it's a whole downtown area. That's what we've been wanting in Oakland. Like, there's a vibrant community in Oakland waiting for something like this to happen and waiting for reasons to go support it. And the Coliseum is not conducive to that. You got to drive in, you got to pull up into that huge parking lot. It's not like you can park nearby and go to dinner and then walk up to the stadium. It's nothing like that. The baseball game is the event. Mm-hmm. And that's not conducive to drawing 20,000+ a night in this mm-hmm. day and age.
Yep. But also it is also about the product on the field, and it is about that. And
oh yeah.
And I will say, and as we've said many times, like, the players are being put in a position to fail. You're putting a roster together of guys who most of them have not been in the major leagues, competing against teams that are, of course, loaded with all-stars and whatnot. Right. But it's still baseball, and that's why you can have nights like last night happen. Last question for you, Kyle. What will kind of sustain? I know I'm sure you had a fair number of alcoholic beverages last night, but of what you will remember the clearest, what will stand out? A moment in the game, of a sign that you saw, a chant, was it, whether it was the non-chant, you know, the silence in the fifth inning, what will kind of stick with you moving forward as the saga is certainly not over, but that night will probably stand on its own?
And the fact that it was the engagement from the fans that will stick with me. It was first batter of the game. You know, I said it was the most exciting three unassisted of all time. Every time there was two strikes on a batter, people were standing up. You know, Brent Rooker doubles and ties it. It was like they won the World Series in there. Like, the place was shaking. It was so loud and it was half full. You know, so that is what's gonna kind of stay for me, is the fact that it didn't die out in the third inning. People didn't get bored. People didn't go, okay, I'm here, I wore my cell t-shirt, let's go home in the fifth. It was everybody stayed for nine innings. Everybody was engaged. Everybody was loud. And that's that. I was really proud to be an A's fan last night.
Yeah. And that's why any of this exists, right? Is because the fans, and because fans do give a shit. And even if you can give them something to give a shit about for one night, because mm-hmm. Hogan Harris threw the game of his life.
Unbelievable. Hogan Harris, bro. Oh my
God, bless, right? I mean, holy shit, right? I mean, this was the blueprint all along, right? Fuji to Harris to May. Game
that's,
over.
Dude, in spring training, if you're drawing it up, that's how it was supposed to go.
Oh my God.
Hey, shout out and to Fuji too.
Fuji. And let me tell you, I will believe in Fuji until they, I mean, I know he's maybe has the worst command in the majors, but holy shit, his stuff is good. That was so cool to watch. He has crazy, 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 crazy stuff. And also, I mean, again, another final agenda. Awesome for Trevor May, right? Trevor May, a guy who maybe doesn't necessarily have, you know, rooted in Oakland ties, but we know what he's been through this season, of course, on the field and off the field, being on the IL for a while with dealing with, you know, anxiety issues. And Trevor May, one of our favorite people in the game. And to see him have that moment was freaking awesome. That ninth inning, yeah.
And especially since in that game against the Brewers was that Sunday, where he really struggled. He came in and I walked four straight guys or whatever it was and got taken out in the ninth of a game that was 8-3. Having him come in and shut it down was really cool. I agree.
Yep. All right, Kyle. Well, thank you for kind of painting a picture for us. We know that there are, I mean, we've heard from all kinds of A's fans, as Jake said, we've heard from people that aren't even baseball fans that were kind of inspired and noticed what happened in Oakland last night. So I'm sure it's something you will always remember, and whatever happens next with the A's, you will always have June 13th with that victory. Hogan Harris.
Me and my buddy, Randy, I've been trying to figure out what I'm going to do if the A's leave, like what I do fandom wise, because I'm not rooting for a John Fisher team. I'm just not. Oh. So me and my buddy Randy he's a disgruntled Cubs fan. We're deciding what's going to be quote unquote our team. So we've had our Padres right now. We've got our Reds.
We're just
bopping around the majors right now, figuring it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Reds are an interesting one where it's like a lot of the fun stuff happening, but you're still not going to be happy with ownership.
Right.
It's like, do I want to pick the teams that the owners are spending like crazy, but the team is still a mess? Like what is going to make me feel better? That is a great existential baseball fan question that you are going to have to figure out.
I wish you luck,
Kyle. Thank you for joining us. You can follow Kyle on Twitter, Kyle A. Madsen. All kinds of photos, videos from last night. Definitely encourage you guys to check that out. But thank you for joining us on Baseball Barbercast, Kyle. We'll talk to you again soon, man.
Thanks, guys.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Enough about the Oakland A's. We spent too long on a team with 19 wins. Let's talk about the big market of New York City. The Subway Series, a little two-game amuse-bouche, kicked off yesterday with the Yankees winning 7-6 in a battle of reeling bizarre baseball clubs. This game was mutually assured destruction. Very few people left the stadium happy. Luis Severino looked like crap. Anthony Volpe did look good. Drew Smith got tossed for having too much goop on his hands. Max Scherzer with like a 4 or 5-1 lead kind of lost it a little bit. No one's happy this morning in New York City, except for Vegas Golden Knights fans living in the Big Apple. I was going to go to this game yesterday, Jordan, but in a bizarre, ironic twist of fate, the A, B, C, D, and E trains were not running. And so I didn't feel like schlepping my way out to Citi Field another way.
The subway is down series.
The subway is not running on time series. A very appropriate.
Yes. As we mentioned, you know, it's just a two-game series, and both of these teams, it's still early for both of these teams, but these are the games when if you open Twitter and you see the reaction from fans, you don't know who's winning. And that's kind of the best and the worst, because it's kind of an exhausting thing that us 28 other fan bases have to kind of listen to from these dramatic New York fans. But I don't blame them. I mean, I know they care. And as you mentioned, like we could go back and forth. Like I you can't feel great about a lot of what was going on here. But the Drew Smith thing, like, I don't know. I mean, how many times are we going to do this where the umps say, oh, well, sticky to me. And the Drew Smith's like, I showed my hands to the MLB official. And he's like laughed at me and said, they're not sticky. Like, I don't know how I'm supposed to talk about this anymore, other than that clearly they need to at least have some level of consistency with the umpires. Like, they need to get on some level of the same page. I'm going to keep laughing about it. I don't want Drew Smith to get suspended for 10 games. Like, that seems stupid, but I also don't really know the best way to handle this.
I totally agree with you. After he got tossed, they cut to him in the dugout, and there was a clip of Drew Smith, Mets reliever, saying, "I don't know what the fuck I'm supposed to do." And that's how I feel about discussing this topic. Yes. Because I don't know how to quantify stickiness. I don't know how to touch man's hands. It's basically the umpire going out there, licking his finger, putting it up in the air and going, "Dat boy sticky." Like, well, I don't know.
Remember, these checks are happening even more than they were the first time they started. Like, they are doing them all the time. And so it's not surprising to me that 0.0005% of the time an umpire is going to feel a hand and be like, "Whoa," like, that's not that surprising to me. But at the same time, I don't know what it really says about where the sport is at, or what the Mets are doing, or Drew Smith's doing, and how it relates to Max Scherzer's sticky hands. Like, I just don't care that much. I really don't. I know it's, like, in theory, a spicy topic, but it doesn't, that's not what I come out of this game wanting to talk about. I want to talk about Anthony Volpe. I want to talk about the fact that Max Scherzer has just not been a good pitcher.
Giancarlo Stanton homering at Citi Field for the 800th time or some
yeah,
shit. Like,
yeah,
like, that's what I want to think about.
And like the end of the game, like the big spot that Marte comes up in, and like Clay Holmes, like the Yankees bullpen, which has just bailed them out over and over and over and over. Like, it has been quietly one of the best bullpens in baseball. Like, there are interesting things going on with these teams with a lot of anonymous players, which is kind of what makes it, I think, less wanting to talk about the game itself, because so many of these players involved are just not necessarily, you know, the marquee names, particularly on the Yankees side, who rolled out an outfield yesterday of Bowers, IKF, and McKinney, and one. So, like, I just, like, that's funny. But to me, that's also kind of a microcosm of why the Yankees are where they're at, and why they're still somehow 10 games over 500, is that they do find ways to kind of win games. And the Mets Absolutely. Have been finding ways to lose them.
Absolutely. I have a quick idea here, right, about the stickiness. So it's not a sustainable model to send an old, wrinkly Pudge King in a black jumpsuit masquerading as an umpire, you know, to just touch a hand and say yes or no. You know who has a reputation for developing impressive technologies? You know who has a lot of free time on her hands? Is Elizabeth Holmes, right? If I'm MLB, I'm giving Elizabeth Holmes 50 mil in prison, and I'm saying, I need you to develop a portable stickiness measurement machine, okay, that umpires can take, touch the hand, put it in the beep bop boop bop, and it says too sticky or not sticky enough.
When we started this podcast, I was like, how can we invoke Elizabeth Holmes in a positive light? Here's my take of that. There are non-morally corrupt scientists, smart people that could also help us with this. Just throwing it out there. But I see, in terms of who has time to do it, you know, okay, that's a fair point.
Rosin meets Theranos, who says no.
I say no.
You say no. Because last thing on the stickiness, like, part of the reason we don't care is that people have been using stuff forever. As long as we don't have Trevor Bauer using, like, cement on his fucking hands, then I don't care.
Let's talk about the Mets and the Yankees still. Oh, Gary Sanchez, former Met, former Yankee. I just want to take a moment to acknowledge the season that he is having. I believe he's up to 6 homers now with the Padres, which I believe Austin Nola has 9 homers as a Padre since arriving at the deadline 2 years ago. Gary has invigorated this Padres offense to a hilarious degree. And my favorite thing about this is that this is the third team he's been on this year. He signs with the Giants at the very beginning of the year. He goes to AAA and absolutely sucks. He gets released. The Mets sign him and immediately put him in the lineup. He absolutely sucks. I mean, he plays like 3 games. And then leave it to Preller, who is in absolute desperation mode, who I would have assumed would have signed him in the first place, but I guess was still caught up on not, you know, holding the L of the Nola trade, and I guess still believing in Camposano or whatever. Here's Gary Sanchez, who is slugging 681 through his first 13 games with the Padres. And another thing where it's like this Padres offense has been so lifeless that any amount of like hot streak or just like hitting it over the fence because with consistency has the entire fan base losing their absolute mind. And we'd love to see it.
I love you saying, referring to Gary Sanchez as former Met, former Yankee.
That's him.
That is an outrageous oversimplification of the man's life.
Yes. Former Twin, I guess, also more recently than the Yankees. I think most people have maybe forgotten about that part. But yeah, Gary, I mean, it's great. Like, Gary hot streaks are as delightful. And by the way, if you watch him catch, he's still kind of doing some dumb Gary. Like, he still had some defensive moments where it's like, what the fuck are you doing? But that's not really the concern of Padres fans at this point.
Speaking of bearded ex-Yankees taking the baseball world by storm, Aaron Hicks. Oh my God. So the Yankees basically release Aaron Hicks and they eat $27 million remaining on his contract. And the Orioles are like, sure, we'll give it a go. And at least the story is the Orioles coaches were like, do this one little trick. You know, like you scroll to the bottom of an internet webpage and it's like, do this one little trick and fix your whole swing. And that's what happened. And Aaron Hicks has been incredible for the Orioles.
I'm trying to remember. I read this quote on the podcast about what Elias said about Hicks when they signed him, where he was basically just like, there's stuff you can't see. That is why we have brought him in. And it's like, all right, dude, like, I believe you. And then he is with a 1200 OPS or whatever. He had a monster homer last night. He's got 8 walks to 7 strikeouts. That kind of thing we sort of expected Hicks maybe could do. But he sure looks like he's having a good time. And it's also one of those things, too, where like you joked, oh, the one Aaron Hicks clutch homer is going to be awesome. Well, he's already given you a couple. He's like, he's already given you multiple moments. Like it can end now and it's already been worth it.
He's gotten on base more times or equal. He's gotten on base equal times as an Oriole and as a Yankee this year already.
That's right. Incredible. In 11 games, yeah, for the Orioles now. I will say, though, not that we want to go too deep on this, Ryan O'Hearn is stunning me even more than Aaron Hicks. I'm just going to go ahead and put that out there. Ryan O'Hearn's 992 OPS is making me question a lot about the Orioles and just what is possible over there because holy shit.
The Orioles hitting cheating lab is outstanding this year.
Oh my God. Anyway, had to acknowledge those. They're much more fun to talk about than whoever is actually playing for the Mets and the Yankees right now.
One last thing about it. Did you see at Orioles tweet, imagine not having Aaron Hicks on your team? It's so good.
I mean, it's like, and right, obviously the Padres are just tweeting out everything Gary, every time Gary sneezes. It's great. It's great. It's wonderful stuff.
I hate the narrative of certain guys can't play in the Bronx because I don't think that's true. I think if players are supported and empowered, they can play anywhere by a coaching staff. And I'm not criticizing like the Yankees coaching staff, just the circumstances for these two guys weren't right. But like being in the Bronx has a weight to it. It has a pressure to it. It's like, I wish it wasn't true because it is really cliche. But over time, it does grade on guys. Like we saw it with Gary. We saw it with Joey Gallo. We saw it with Aaron Hicks. You see it all the time, right? Every year, it feels like there's a player who gets like bullied out of the Bronx and then has success somewhere else. And I think even though the Yankees are good at a lot of player development stuff and getting the most out of like the Jake Bowerses of the world, that organization has yet to really figure out how to take these struggling older players who have high expectations and make them feel comfortable enough to contribute. Jacoby Ellsbury, right, is another one.
Right.
Guy who,
how do you
who
course
kind of fell on hard times.
The guy it's kind of trending in the wrong direction. Whereas like the younger guys, like relatively like Bowers and Calhoun, I mean, they're playing for their job. Like it's different because like they know this is their chance to be major leaguers in a way that the other guys, they've already been there, done that. But now it's just like exhausting to exist as a Yankee.
How do you create the energy of a change of scenery internally? Mm-hmm. Right. That's really difficult to do for any team. In New York, it's even harder because of the pressure from the fan base. I think about like the 2021 Giants and what they were able to do with Brandon Belt and Brandon Crawford and all those guys, where it was like, it felt like a change of scenery for the whole team, but no one left. So that's just something that's on my mind as I watch these former Yankees flourish elsewhere.
Let's move on, Jake Mintz, to another player who Yankees fans do not particularly enjoy watching succeed. How about that transition? Carlos Correa. Carlos Correa hit a monster walk-off home run last night against Devin Williams, who had a rare super clunker, just total mess of an outing for Devin Williams. The two middling, I guess the Brewers aren't currently leading the division because the Pirates are, but the two, I guess, de facto favorites in the extremely underwhelming Central divisions, we have the Brewers in Minnesota. And Carlos Correa, who has been so underwhelming in his return to Minnesota, is finally heating up. It wasn't just last night. I believe that is his third or fourth homer in the last week or so. He looked great against Toronto. And that swing and that reaction was finally, because he really didn't have anything like this last year, and that was part of just the season that the Twins had. That was it. That was the moment we have all kind of been envisioning. It was really freaking cool. I know there are a lot of people that don't like Correa no matter what, and that's fine. But we are generally pro-Correa on this pod, and I thought that was freaking sweet because it was just a reminder of the kind of talent that he is and the kind of swings he is capable of when he is right.
When he first did the watch tap celebration, like the It's My Time celebration, it was him kind of saying, when he did in the playoffs, I think, against Eduardo Rodriguez, it was like, it's always my time. Like, it's me. When he did it this time, it was like, it's about damn time. It's my time. Like, I've been terrible. Like, I'm glad I'm eating up now. Like,
yeah, it was about
now,
time.
Now it's time.
No, it was about time, I think, is probably what he was going for there. But yeah, no, it was cool, man. And then, you know, not a lot of homers hit off the Devin Williams airbender to the second deck. So, you know, you're putting a good swing on it there. And honestly, like, it hasn't just been Correa. Like, this Twins offense has truly been abysmal. And it's not going to take much to, again, not quite the same way it was, like, you know, add Gary to the Padres, but even more so because the Padres have at least had Soto and Tatis has been good. But this Twins lineup right now, like, they're being carried by freaking Donovan Solano. Like, I know that Buxton has, of course, been hurt and Gallo has certainly cooled off since the beginning, but they need something. I mean, I know that Correa could be better than this. And this is, you know, his WRC plus is still 98, but we're trending in the right direction.
There have been some signs of life from a couple of the younger players in Minnesota between Alex Kirilloff and Edouard Julien, who's been really good since coming back up. Royce Lewis has kind of held water since he got promoted. And so this team needs to win the division. They have to. Like, the fact that they're not running away with it even more is really embarrassing. They're so much better than a lot of these other teams. And I think that all it's going to take is like 3 weeks of the offense returning to where they should be, and they'll create some separation.
I agree, because Cleveland over the last couple of weeks has shown signs of figuring it out, and Minnesota should be up by 10 games right now, and they're not. So, like, this is an opportunity that should really, really not go to waste for the Twins here, because I agree, like, they've clearly figured out the pitching. So the pitching has been marvelous. Pitching has been as impressive as the hitting has been underwhelming, and hopefully Correa can start to kind of turn that more in the proper direction. All right, Jake, we have one more topic before we get to an email. And that is something that if we did the show yesterday, we probably would have led off with. But then the A's beat the Rays for a seventh consecutive win, and a lot of other stuff happened in the Coliseum. So that's why we started the show with it. But Jake, Gunnar Henderson and Corbin Carroll, the top two prospects coming into the season this year by most outlets, I would say. Both of them just won their respective leagues Player of the Week, not Rookie of the Week, Player of the Week last week. And they are both just completely on fire. Corbin Carroll hit another home run last night, as did Gunnar with the Grand Slam. The Gunnar Grand Slam last night, who do you want to talk about first? Because they are clearly interrelated, but they are also both different, very different kinds of players. So who would you like to begin with?
Let's begin with Corbin Carroll, who is a very unique player. He is unique in that you can go to a baseball game as a neutral, casual fan for one night, and you can leave knowing that Corbin Carroll is a special player. Because on any given evening, he'll do something that looks different. He moves different at the outfield, right? His swing looks a lot different than a lot of players. It's kind of almost the, like the, Japanese style, like kind of pulling out, not all the way Ichiro, but like he's definitely moving his body towards first a lot as he swings. You just see that it's unique and it's different and it's special. And he has highlighted that since day one. And when the Diamondbacks gave him this enormous extension before he even played a game in the, you know, a number of games in the big leagues, I know he came up at the end of last year. It was the type of thing where it's like, yeah, this is risky, but the Diamondbacks probably had like a bunch of conversations with the kid and they're like, oh, he's the real deal. Like sometimes scouting is not hard. Sometimes it's a conversation and 3 days at the park. What is hard and what is impressive is finding a kid like that out of a Seattle area high school when he's 18 years old. Giving him an extension at 22, like that's just, that's whatever. For me, it's the fact that they identified this kid coming out of high school, right? That they had enough trust in the bat after he was facing kids presumably throwing 81 miles an hour in Washington State.
Sure. Well, and the thing, and he was unbelievable on the showcase circuit. I have a piece going up today at Fox Sports all about Corbin Carroll. And the main thing I was kind of harping on is the power is shocking to kind of witness because he's listed at 5'10", 165. And the kind of exit velos he's producing for a player that maybe he's 175 or 185, like he is not big. And just the wrist strength and the bat speed that he's producing against both lefties and righties and powering balls to all fields is kind of shocking. It's really, there's very few players like that that are in the league, not to mention that he's one of the five fastest players in baseball. So that is why we are talking about someone that's very unique. This is a good transition to Gunnar because you look at them like, oh, well, of course, the top two prospects in baseball are balling out. Like this is the whole point, right? This is why we do prospect lists is because we want the people who watch these players at younger ages, whether it's in amateur ball or whether it's in the minors, to say these guys are going to be some of the best players in baseball. And here they are, some of the best players in baseball. And you joked before we started recording, like, wow, people are good at this. People are good at this. But you also mentioned, again, how do you identify that out of high school? How do you identify that out of a tiny private school, even in Alabama, which is where Gunnar Henderson came from? And you don't have to look farther than the rest of the high school players that were drafted at the top of the 2019 first round, right? I mean, yes, Bobby Witt Jr. was of course, notably, you know, the guy who went second overall, and I still believe in him. Riley Green, we'll see. I think Riley Green can be good. CJ Abrams, right? Brett Beatty, we're still waiting on. Keone Kavako, who's probably not going to make it to the big leagues, was drafted before Corbin Carroll. I mean, there's a lot of high school. This is the Volpe draft, right? And we know that Volpe has... he's slowly figuring it out, but it's not clicking this quickly. It's not supposed to be this easy the way that Carroll and Henderson made it look last year and are making it look this year. Henderson went, you know, at the top of the second round of this draft as well. So it's not that simple. And so to be able to identify those guys and develop them is really amazing.
Henderson, they're so different, dude. Because Henderson's just like, big boy, go far, right? Like,
but he's not. Now he's not huge, though. He's not. He's clearly ridiculously strong. We saw it with the homer to Utah Street. The grand slam last night, though, that was, if you want to show what backspinning a baseball looks like, I couldn't believe that it carried to that degree. It was this, and Kiermaier still looked like he thought he had a play on it, but that ball just kept going. It was wild.
So when I wrote about Masataka Yoshida earlier this year, I had a conversation with Alex Cora, Red Sox manager, about where Yoshida's power comes from. And he talked a lot about not just his huge tree trunk legs, but Yoshida's innate ability to backspin a baseball. Mm-hmm. And that is a very difficult thing to teach and to learn and to develop, right? Because a lot of it has to do with swing path. Albert Pujols is the GOAT at this, right? His swing was perfectly engineered to backspin a baseball. But it's such an important thing that is so hard to learn. And just Gunnar Henderson has it. He can, that ball, the grand slam he hit out, looked like a fly out to center, right? And the ball just took off to left center because it's backspinning so much, it stays on plane up in the air. He's remarkable, man. And he was super passive to start the season.
Yeah,
at the plate, like he wasn't being aggressive enough to spots in the zone. And now he is. And I think it's starting to click for him. And he's a great, great at-bat tool.
And that's what we had been talking about earlier in the season. It's like, how worried are we about Gunnar? And it, like, not really, because the at-bats are still pretty good, but it's like, dude, you have this power. You have this incredible swing. You need to use it, because otherwise you're just going to keep striking out and you're going to keep walking and not really impacting the game on offense. Through May 21st, Gunnar was hitting 192, 331, again, showing how much he was still getting on base, 354. 354 slug through May 21st. Since then, which is, I think, what, 20 games, I would say, he's hitting 377, 421, 774 with six homers, two doubles, 1195 OPS over his last 16 games. So it's wild. Obviously, the Orioles offense was already pretty good before that, but he's really added a new level that is amazing. And they're both, 22. They're both so this is it. I mean, these two guys are going to be, and the most exciting part about it, all of it, is this could have been happening on two teams that were projected to win 78 games and it would have been awesome. But instead, they're two teams that might win 90 games, and that makes it all the more exciting.
100%. Let's do an email and then we will get on out of here. Jordan, people know about an immaculate inning, but what about an un-immaculate inning? This email comes from Logan. He says, "Hey guys, loved your last mailbag pod, especially all the strategy on designated milk drinkers. If you didn't listen to that one, you're confused right now. A baseball thought experiment I've been having recently is this. If an immaculate inning is three outs on non-strikes, what could an in-immaculate inning look like? I'd love to hear your takes on what that could be. Thanks, Logan." Jordan, what comes to mind for you?
I love this, right? First of all, immaculate innings are, I know some, Aaron Goldsmith, I know of our Mariners broadcaster, obsessed with immaculate innings. When you get the first, some Mariners pitcher has the first six or seven strikes, you can hear him giddy on the mic for the possibility. So I know people really care about it, but what's the opposite, right? What is the worst possible thing? Well, the easiest thing is, I mean, to me, the unimmaculate inning has to end with you getting taken out, right? Or is it an inning that is completed? Like, I'm curious, is this an inning that is disastrous, or is it still an inning that you complete and get all three outs, but it is unimmaculate? What do you think?
So it's not an inning if you don't get three outs.
Great point. So you do have to get three outs. Okay, so we're implying, we are assuming that we are completing the three outs. So what is the least impressive way you can complete three outs? I would say it could be just three balls scorched at like 115 to all three outfielders. That would be one way. But in some ways, that's immaculate defense.
Three home run robberies in a row.
Three home run robberies in a row. But again, you would remember that but that is a good one, right? Because in theory, you have allowed three home runs and completed the inning. What are some other ways that would be the opposite of immaculate?
In my mind, 16 straight balls to start the inning.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
16 consecutive balls.
Whoa, no. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
For a run.
For a run. I thought it was just to load the bases and then still get. Okay. Okay.
No. 16 straight balls to start the inning. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, your manager is like, leave him out there.
Okay. Used a lot of our bullpen last night. We're just gonna have to eat 16 straight balls. I wonder if that's ever been like. I'm trying to. That certainly happened in college, but I'm trying to.
Okay, but you still need outs. You still need outs. Okay,
yeah, so
16 straight balls.
I know.
And I think the play that is the least impressive for a pitcher, right, is when they allow a hit, and yet outs are made on the bases by toot blanding, by making mistakes as a base runner. And so what I'm envisioning is like the bases are loaded after 16 consecutive balls and a ball is hit in the gap.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The runner on third like falls down running home and is passed by both of the runners.
Both of them. Both runners are passing them.
Both
oh my
the
God.
And somehow all three runners are tagged out on the play.
You're basically asking for an honest, like basically a triple play incurred by the offense.
Correct. So,
like, like running into a triple play is what you're hoping for after walking the bases loaded and walking in a run.
And then allowing a hit.
Yes. Because I think you could do the 16 straight balls or even 12 straight balls, followed by a 3-0 count they swing after 19 straight balls and they pop it out. And then maybe the next one is like a really unlucky liner to first base where the first baseman just steps on second and doubles the guy, or steps on first and doubles the guy off. I think
it makes
that
me think about a great baseball situation I really, really love is like tie game late, runners on second and third, reliever allows a single, runner on third scores, runner on second is thrown out trying to score.
Mm.
And it's like you're losing, but there was just a great defensive play and the pitcher is like pissed as shit and the outfielder's right on cloud nine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, again, the other obvious point, which I think may have came up in other previous mailbag scenarios, is there's probably some pitch clock related answers that would have been interesting here. That makes me think that like, oh no, I guess that doesn't really make sense. I'm like, if we could get some catcher's interference involved, but that's really more helping the batter. I don't know. I do think that a lot of balls in a row, because again, when we think about immaculate, we think about, and also we think about just perfect games, we think about clean, right? We think about that it is like a spotless inning. It is very, very pristine in the scorebook and everything is very straightforward. And a lot of balls in a row is not that.
But there's also the experience of when you're watching an immaculate inning, it's like, oh my God, is this dude going to throw another strike? And that's what I want the opposite of. Like, oh my God, is this dude going to throw another ball?
Which also makes me think like hit by pitches also would probably help here. Wild pitches maybe. Oh, maybe like a wild pitch like situation where it's like a bunch of balls and then you a bunch of drop third strikes. But no, I guess that's still a strikeout.
Ooh, I got it. Okay. 16 straight balls.
You really want that run to come in. You really want to. You don't even just want to load the bases. You want to walk a run in. Okay.
You got to walk a run in for it to be unimmaculate. Okay. And then three consecutive pass balls in which the runners are thrown out at home. Like,
yes,
the pitcher covering home.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Perfect ricochets. And that's how you
like the pitcher has no idea where the ball is.
The pitcher literally has thrown zero strikes and gets out of it, but also allows a run. But you could. No, actually, I think it's actually even better is you don't walk in a run. It's the 12 straight balls, bases loaded, and then three straight pass balls where all three runners try to advance and score, and they all get thrown out. So it's a scoreless inning. It's a scoreless inning, but they've thrown zero strikes. That's it. We did it, Joe. We figured it out. All right. Great work, team. Thank you to Logan who emailed us this. This is a great question.
I want to give a quick shout out actually here before we go. Immaculate Grid. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm vaguely familiar, but pump it because I want to hear more.
A big listener of our show sent this to us. I believe this person listens to a lot of them, so shouts out. Didn't get a name, but if you go to immaculategrid.com, it's like a very fun daily baseball game. So I love like the New York Times crossword puzzle and the spelling bee and whatever. And this is kind of like the baseball version of that. I know we had like Wardle, which became MLB Pickle, and that one's great too. This one is more like historical, and you can kind of do it a little bit quicker and requires a kind of a different knowledge set, and it's super fun. I've been playing it every day. Highly recommend checking out immaculategrid.com.
There you go. Definitively immaculate, not unimmaculate, like what Logan is describing. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. Thank you all for those wonderful emails. We'll hopefully get to more of those soon, but we have to end this podcast because Jake has to fly to Omaha. I'm flying to Omaha later. We will be back on Friday. We will be in the same place recording a Baseball Barbacast from Omaha, Nebraska. Looking forward to that. But until then, thank you to Chris Tyler for producing this here podcast as always. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for co-hosting. Thank you, Kyle Madsen, for joining us to talk about the reverse boycott. And until next time, have a good next couple days.
SiriusXM Podcasts.